Thank you, Mr. Sabota, but I just have an announcement before you begin, if you would. We have with us students from Stevens Point High School. Would you please stand? Well, we want to welcome you, and the name of the high school is?
Spash.
Right, and I've been fortunate enough to have lectured at your high school several times and on the high school graduation address, so I especially want to welcome you, feeling that you're old friends, or new friends.
Being my hometown, I do too.
Okay, you may be seated. And we have students from Platteville High School. Would they please stand? Been to Platteville many times as other members of this court, and thank you for coming. Thank you, sir. You may be seated. These students are here with us on our Court with Class program. It's a program we run with the State Bar of Wisconsin, and it has won two national awards in our outreach to citizens of this state as part of our collaboration and partnership with citizens of this state for a better understanding of court proceedings. So we're delighted you have come. All of the students will meet with retired Chief Justice Roland Day at lunch to discuss the procedures of this court. And anyone else in attendance may also stay for these discussions as you see fit. With that announcement of who's in the courtroom, at the other side of the bench, I do want to introduce to you all the members of the Supreme Court. On my far left is Justice David Prosser. To his right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. To my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. I am Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice of this court. To my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. And to his right, Justice John Wilcox. And at the far right, Justice Patrick Crooks. With those introductions made, we will now call the first case, and it's Wisconsin Electric Power Company versus LERP 97-2747-FT, and appearing for the state of Wisconsin is Assistant Attorney General Stephen M. Sabota. Before you begin, Jack is taking care of extra chairs. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Sabota.
Thank you, Your Honor, and thank you for the introduction. It saves me a little work in the beginning of my speech. I do want to just acknowledge, though, that I represent the petitioner in this case, the Labor and Industry Review Commission. That's the administrative agency whose decision is under review by this court today on our petition. We're asking, of course, that this court reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals District 1, which had the result of denying compensation to the estate of Scott Overby in this case. Can I also, before I begin the body of the argument, I'm going to use some either acronyms or abbreviations throughout, if I could. I'm going to refer to the employer, Wisconsin Electric Power Company, as WEPCO, if that's okay with everybody. I'll refer to the Overbys because we had both a husband and wife who were killed as the Overbys or Overby, and of course I'll refer to the commission as the commission. This is a case that involves, and it's a very tragic case, I want to make that clear at the beginning because we did have two fatalities that resulted. It involves the application of Section 102.03.1F of the Workers' Compensation Act. And especially for the benefit of our guests this morning, Your Honors, this is a statute that was passed by the Wisconsin Legislature in 1945, and it was basically meant to cover the type of classic traveling salesman that Arthur Miller described, in other words, Willie Loman, in Death of a Salesman, the commercial traveler out on the road. And the early cases in this court referred to it as the traveling salesman's, and it was man, masculine statute. Since then, of course, because it's much broader than that, it's now referred to as the traveling employee statute, and again, that's what I'll refer to it as. What happened in this case, just briefly as far as the facts, is work awarded benefits to the Overby estate in a situation where the husband, Scott Overby, had been in Dallas, Texas to attend a business seminar for a one-week period in February, or early, late January and early February of 1995. The seminar had officially ended at noon on February 3rd, 1995. The accident took place approximately 2:30 p.m. that afternoon, and it took place while the Overbys and a co-worker of Mr. Overby, Donald Kerber, were on a sightseeing excursion to Fort Worth, Texas. We know from the record that they had traveled approximately 21 miles from their hotel and were probably going to make a trip in the Fort Worth, which is due west, of about 30 miles maximum to complete the sightseeing purpose. In the accident, Mrs. Overby, who was directly behind her husband, who was driving, was killed instantly, and Scott Overby died approximately 6 months later as a result of the severe injuries he sustained. The reason that this case is here is because rather than leaving on Friday the 3rd when the seminar had done, Overby had elected to extend his stay in Texas pursuant to a travel reimbursement policy that WEPCO had in place. And I think this court well understands that what the gist of the travel policy was is if Overby flew back on either a Saturday or Sunday on Midwest Express, he got a cheaper ticket than if he would have flown back on Friday. The Friday ticket would have been $833. The ticket on either Saturday or Sunday was $161. So the savings differential was $672. What WEPCO's policy was, what they basically said to the Overbys, you have $672 that you've saved the company. We will let you stay one extra night in Texas, and we will pay for what they called one night's worth of expenses. That would be the hotel room, the meals on Friday night, and I guess whatever you would call some kind of travel or incidental expenses. What Overby had done, however, was to decide to extend the stay also to cover Saturday night, and he arranged under his own auspices to bring his wife down. She came, I think, late Friday morning with a ticket that he paid for out of his own pocket and joined her husband right after the end of the seminar, so shortly after noon on Friday.
Would you be here if this accident had happened Sunday evening? Does the closeness of the accident to the getting off of Friday, based on the seminar and the fact that the company had this policy, would that extend for the entire duration of this employee's alleged deviation?
Could I ask, Your Honor, if you could just tell me a little bit more when on Sunday you're talking about, like,
well,
the trip to the airport to get the plane and return the car type of thing?
Yes.
I don't think we'd be here because if I understand the WEPCO policy, I think what they would say is once he left the Omni Hotel to go to the Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport, he was basically back in the course of employment. And if the car accident would have happened on that route, I don't think there would be. But I'll obviously let Ms. English state that. But I don't think that would be an issue under those facts.
See, their argument basically is if we accept this employee deviation, that literally eviscerates the statute that you refer to. And that's why I'm asking the question as far as we're familiar with CBS and some
right.
other cases. But the point is, what's the logical stopping point? Do we look at this just a case by case? And why shouldn't we say no, that he was on a personal errand?
Let me answer this by saying it was stipulated by Overby's counsel at the time of the hearing that this trip was indeed a deviation. There's no question they're going 30 miles due west from their hotel. The question under the statute becomes whether it was a deviation for a personal or private reason is the answer.
This was.
Yeah, okay. But then the question becomes, you have to look at the further language of the statute, because there's more to it than that, because the statute tells us that, quote, acts reasonably necessary for living or incidental thereto shall not be regarded as such a deviation. And that's the actual finding that the commission made in this case, and very much in line with what this court said in CBS. They looked at it based upon the individual facts of this case, and based upon those particular facts, their conclusion was, and let me give you their exact language because it's quite significant. This you could find in the appendix to our brief in chief at page 130, and I'm quoting from the commission memorandum decision. Here, of course, the record does not establish that the applicant had deviated by drinking an unreasonable amount of alcohol, or that he was leaving the Dallas-Fort Worth metropolitan area on a side trip for personal reasons, period. Rather, he was simply seeking an innocent diversion while in the Dallas-Fort Worth area on a business trip, period. Sightseeing while on a business trip in and of itself is not a deviation, comma, but rather reasonable recreation incidental to living, end of quote.
Mr. Sabota, the last time you were here, and we discussed the internal conflict between these sentences.
Are you talking about the CBS case?
Yes.
It was my colleague, Mr. Noss, but I'm well aware of, you know, what happened in CBS, right?
And we discussed that there's an inherent conflict between saying that that when there's a deviation to private or personal purpose, it's not covered.
Right.
But then the second sentence is, well, you got to live. You got to have incidental to living various trips, various activities. And that's not a deviation.
Correct.
And the problem is that the legislature has done two things in this statute. Personal is a deviation, but living, incidental to living, is not a deviation. And the problem is we don't know which falls into which sentence.
That's why, and I hope the court had a chance to look at the supplemental materials that I delivered to you, because I think it's real significant the way the statute developed in 1945 and thereafter. If you look at those materials.
Now, these were sent out, and we got them very recently. They're dated April 6th.
Correct.
My office got them on the 7th, and did you get a copy of this, counsel? Ms. English, you got a copy. You have no objection to reference to this?
No.
Counsel?
Okay. In 1945, and I'm looking at page 3 of the actual synopsis of those materials, and these are from these biennial workers' compensation pamphlets, which I think this court is familiar with because you've cited them in the Pigeon case and Lisney. In 1945, that particular sentence, and it's then the last sentence of the statute, it just says, acts reasonably necessary for living shall not be regarded as such deviation. And if you look at the footnote, which is footnote 7, it's real interesting because the footnote says, acts reasonably necessary for living, such as eating, bathing, sleeping, and then there's a ETC, etc., are not to be regarded as a deviation. Now, what this statute had been intended to do in 1945, there were a number of cases that were preceding it, one of which was the Gibbs Steel case, where the traveling salesman slips and falls in his hotel room bathroom. And before this statute came into effect, the court's ruling was in effect, hey, you can slip and fall in your bathroom at home, and that's not covered. It's not going to be covered just because you're traveling. So that's what this was intended to do. Now, the footnote actually seems to be a little bit broader because that et cetera obviously meant something. So as these materials tell you, after the Armstrong case, which WEPCO relies heavily upon in their brief, was decided, and I think that was in December 15th, 1948, by laws, Chapter 107, laws of 1949, which became effective June 1st, 1949, the legislature put in those three little additional words, quote, or incidental thereto, unquote. They also did something else, and you'll see that that's referred to in the materials. But my argument to your honors is, I think the legislature and the people that were administering the act at that time were concerned that we may have put in a statute that basically only covers what WEPCO refers to in their brief, and I'm looking at page 13, they call them acts of daily living while, quote, on the road, unquote. And that would be the classic bathing, eating, sleeping type of situation. So the words or incidental thereto, in my mind, and especially in light of the denial of compensation in Armstrong, which was a case where apparently the deviation was based on the fact that Mr. Armstrong said he was going across the river in Detroit to visit relatives, they wanted to make it broader, and they wanted to, as the Chief Justice said, there's more to living on the road than just eating, sleeping, and bathing type of thing. Well, so that's why I think that language is significant.
Let me say that the practice of encouraging employees to stay over Saturday night to take advantage of airplane rates is really quite widespread.
Could I just make one correction, Your Honor? In this case, as all Mr. Overby had to do was basically stay over Friday night, and that's the night they paid for, because he could have gotten the $161 fare and left on Saturday as opposed to Sunday. So everyone concedes he was paying for Saturday, or would have been paying for Saturday night himself.
And he was injured on?
Friday afternoon at 2:30, correct.
So I'll just, most of the people deal with a Saturday night overstay.
Right.
Does it matter whether it's Friday or Saturday? I mean, as long as he was injured on Friday.
Right,
here,
and that's a point that the commission found significant, that the accident took place on Friday.
One would expect that, because after that, there may be a real question to state. All right. And many times I don't stay over because it's just too cumbersome for my schedule and my wanting to come back. But many times I do. But clearly I would not stay over if I was a prisoner in the hotel. Or a prisoner in the hotel most of the time, but I could go out to a neighborhood restaurant to eat. And in light of that, I assume your argument would be that I could do various reasonable things like sightsee, take in a museum.
Downhill skiing, we know from CBS.
Downhill skiing, not for me, counsel, not for me. I'd watch skiing, could probably get injured by someone knocking into me, but okay. What couldn't I do on my stay over on Friday afternoon? What would Lurk or you argue was beyond the pale? I mean, he's driving 30 miles to do some sightseeing, if I remember the facts, and he's injured at 21 miles. He might have been injured within a mile.
I had a discussion last night at the dinner table with my wife and son, because we knew this question was coming, and I've got a hypothetical, and I'll tell you what I think.
I'm sorry I'm so predictable, counsel. I'm going to try hard.
Not necessarily, Your Honor, but somebody was going to ask it. Take the Overbys and put them in the hotel on late Friday night, okay? They've had their dinner either at the hotel or at one of the, as you said, very neighboring restaurants. They hear that if they head due south toward Waco, Texas, there's a chance for them to hear a really good country and western band at a very out-of-the-way country bar. They are big country and western music fans. Unfortunately, by the time they get this information, it's quite late at night, let's say 10:30, 11 o'clock. The bar, I think, is open until 2 o'clock. In Texas, maybe it's 1. But in addition to that factor, the person who tells them about this says, once you get off the main highway, the roads to get to this place are terrible. You basically need a four-wheel drive vehicle. The other problem is it's raining cats and dogs, and the roads that you have to go through are these what they call dry gulches in Texas, which flood rather easily. And the third problem is the bartender, and I think he's the person at the hotel who told them about this, said, this place is located in what I would call a very bad neighborhood, and if it were just Mrs. Overby alone, I wouldn't tell her to go here, but as long as the two of you are going together, I guess it's safe. Under those circumstances, Your Honor, I think a trier of fact like the commission could find that was an unreasonable deviation, and it was solely personal and private, and not an act reasonably necessary for a living or incidental thereto.
Gee, my question, my example was going to be if, since I'm from central Wisconsin, would be if he wanted to go hunt javelinas, which are a small pig in Texas, and decided to take his wife along, and there was a hunting accident. Now, it would seem to me, despite the CBS scheme, that this would be an example of a strictly personal. So you could give a number of examples, but it has to be something that is different than sightseeing.
Right.
You feel that sightseeing falls within...
I definitely feel that reasonable sightseeing, Your Honor, and that is going to have to be, unfortunately, because I don't think this court can write a bright line rule. I think that's going to have to rise and fall on the circumstances of each individual case.
So hunting and fishing, and he went on a boat, and
yeah, the one case that we cited, or not, we cited two cases from the New York courts to you, was a boat trip, and it was under fairly similar circumstances where the people had finished their business on a Sunday and were going to be flying back on a Monday morning, and were invited to go on a boat trip on Sunday by the customer they were working with. And that was found to be compensable, and I think under those circumstances, taking a motorboat trip while you're in Florida is fairly innocuous and fairly reasonable, necessary for living. But as you said...
Let me, if I might interrupt for a minute, wasn't there testimony to the effect that they were going to go to a rodeo? So how do we draw the line now? This wasn't just sightseeing then, it was attending a rodeo.
Okay, it was, the plans, as I understand it, Your Honor, were not definite. What they had heard about the rodeo in Texas, and I think the way I understand the testimony is they were interested in checking it out to see, I guess, like whether tickets were available or, you know, whether it was something they wanted to do. So the way I understand it is they were definitely interested in checking out the prospect. If things would have worked out, I think the idea was they would have attended the rodeo and then obviously returned to their hotel. But they didn't have tickets in hand when they left.
What if they had gone to the rodeo and the accident took place on the way back? Would that have made any difference?
In my view, I don't think that would change anything. I think that's still going to be a reasonable incident of living on the road. If you look in the transcript, Your Honor, you'll see there's testimony that during the week, Mr. Overby and Mr. Kerber had gone to an NHL hockey game in Dallas at the Reunion Arena, and it was very clear that they had used the rental car for that purpose. They got their meals right at the Reunion Arena, charged the company for the meals, but paid for the hockey tickets out of their own pockets because they realized that that would not be reimbursable by the company. That was their personal expense.
Do the cases help us at all in terms of distance? For instance, here we're talking about 21 miles, 30 miles to Fort Worth. If it was 100 miles, do the cases indicate then that's a deviation?
No, the cases tell us that just the amount of mileage itself is not controlling. That's certainly a factor to take into account, but it's not the rule alone. This court has never, in effect, you know, put the employee on the short leash, so to speak, and say you can only go X number of miles. So that's not the rule. But I agree, 100 miles is more than 30 and more than 21, and that's going to clearly go to the question of reasonableness.
Mr. Sabota, Justice Bradley has had a question, and then Justice Babbage.
It seems to me that the way these cases have developed, the bright line is this. If it's not innocent behavior, and we're talking about the cases, if you're drinking too much or if you're in a hotel room with a prostitute, that's not innocent. So that's not a personal, that's not an acceptable deviation.
Right.
Or if it's not reasonable, however you define that. And it's very amorphous. So why should these court cases even come to the Supreme Court, given the great weight deference of to Lurk? Why isn't your definition of innocence just as good as a fact-specific definition of the Supreme Court as to what's innocent? Maybe for you, inebriation would be innocent if it were at 0.10, and for us it would be 0.05. But we have to give great weight deference.
Right.
Why should these cases even come to the Supreme Court?
Well, let me start this way, Your Honor. Number one...
You're the petitioner. Why should you even bring it before us?
Right. Number one, it's not my wish that it was here. I wish that... No. Honestly, in light of your decision in CBS, I would have hoped that the Court of Appeals District 1 would have summarily affirmed the award of compensation in this case in an unpublished per curiam decision. I was amazed by the decision from District 1. It was a 2-1 split, but when, as you said, in CBS, you told the courts of this state in no uncertain terms to pay great weight deference to commission determinations under this statute. And the Court of Appeals started out and they cite CBS and they say, well, we recognize that, sure, we'll give them due weight deference, and now we're going to reverse, and our rationale for doing that is it's clear to us that the Overbees were engaged in this so-called mini-vacation. Now, I'll be the first one to concede that there's no question that the Overbees had arranged this long weekend in advance, but how that becomes a quote-unquote mini-vacation which disqualifies the Overbees for compensation, to me, is a real, real big leap of faith. The reason the court, this case is here, and this is the reason I tried to make clear to the court in my petition, is that it was absolutely devastating to the practitioners and the commission and the courts of the state after your clear message in CBS to say, wait a minute, downhill skiing in Norway is covered and driving 30 miles at 2:30 p.m. on a Friday afternoon with your own wife and no drinking involved is not covered? I mean, let's face it, that does not lead to consistency and uniformity in the application of this statute. And I think the reason that this court took this case and the reason that you, I'm afraid, are going to have to say again to everyone down below is we want the commission to have a great deal of discretion in this particular type of situation because we're confident that they can do the job. They've been doing it since 1945, and apparently with no, you know, untoward results, and it's basically their call. And unless their call is against a clear, published appellate decision of this case, of this court, which I don't think this case involves, or unless it's totally unreasonable under the clear language of the traveling employee statute, which I don't think it is, the commission decision stands. The other reason, Your Honor, is I think that the message that's been sent out as a result of the Court of Appeals decision, which thank God was not recommended for publication, is that employers should do everything in their power to, as the Chief Justice said, tell employees that they have to stay secluded in their hotel rooms. Because if you give any hint of encouragement to a traveling employee that they can engage in any activities like reasonable sightseeing or recreation, you're basically giving them carte blanche to do basically anything they please. And I don't think that's the public policy that either the legislature or this court wants to promulgate for the state of Wisconsin.
I didn't understand that. You were suggesting that this court say that unless employers say stick to the hotel, it becomes incidental to living expense?
No, Your Honor. What I'm asking this court to say is that a commission decision that reasonably comports with appellate case law and the language of the statute should be upheld.
I understand that.
Right.
But you're saying that if the employer wants them to be on the short lease, the employer has to tell them that. If the employer doesn't, then you come under what's reasonable and to make the decision.
Okay. That gets into a real slippery slope area about what rights the employer has in that particular area.
Good. You don't want us to say anything about that.
Well, I want to say something about it because in the Garver case, the case from Florida, which I cite to you, that was one of the factors that the Florida court said to look at is what restrictions, if any, did the employer place on the employee, which I guess indicates to me that the employer may have some rights in that area. But in this particular case, that factor is really irrelevant because the testimony is absolutely clear from Mr. Kerber in this case that there were no restrictions at all placed up by WEPCO on what they could do either during the course of the seminar week or until their return trip to Milwaukee. They were basically, you know, free.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Your time.
I'm sorry.
Justice Babbage will ask you the question in
okay,
the,
thank you.
The end.
Minutes.
Okay. Thanks, Mr.
Okay.
Ms. English, representing the Wisconsin Electric Power Company.
Good morning. My name is Lynn English. I'm here on behalf of Wisconsin Electric Power Company. As Mr. Sabota described, we're here because of what we believe is LERC's erroneous application and interpretation of the traveling employees provision of the Workers' Compensation Act. One correction in the recitation of the facts, Mr. Overby was injured on February 5 of 1995. He was actually in a coma for a long time. He died in May of 96, not 6 months later. I know his death and that of his wife, Linda, affected many of our employees very deeply. Linda's father and brother also worked for the company, so it was very, very tragic. But the legal issue involves LERC's failing to find that Mr. Overby was engaged in a personal deviation despite three very compelling factors pointing to a deviation. The first is that at the time of the accident on Friday afternoon, Mr. Overby had concluded the business part of his trip, which had ended at 12 noon, and had embarked on the second factor is he had embarked on a pre-planned personal vacation with his wife. He was not even planning to return until Sunday. And the third factor is he was traveling to a different city over 30 miles away. And I think each of you have touched on those three different factors to some degree. I do want to say, though, that I think the issue here and perhaps the difference between this case and the CBS case, you wouldn't have to have necessarily all of those factors, but the important factor is that the business part of the trip had concluded. The employee voluntarily chose to stay longer than was necessary for the business reason for the trip. And then, especially if you're traveling in a distance, when you add all those together, I think that the legislative intent of the traveling employees provision was to find a personal deviation in those circumstances. With respect to the distance questions we've had, I guess I would like to interject a personal note. I was actually born in Dallas, Texas, and raised there and lived there for 22 years. So I am somewhat familiar with the maps and the locales here. And I think that LERC made a real fundamental error because in its opinion, it said, well, you know, an employee can deviate if they drink too much alcohol or if they go too far away from the city that was the destination of their business trip. And then they failed to even note that Mr. Overby had done exactly that. And they say, well, it's the Dallas-Fort Worth metropolitan area because they do call it the DFW airport. Well, when somebody asks me where I'm from, I say I'm from Dallas. I don't say I'm from the Dallas-Fort Worth metropolitan area. And personally, I've lived there 22 years, and I've only been to Fort Worth three times in my life. So it's not real common for people just to go over to Fort Worth. So I do think that's a significant fact.
Was that a fact in the record?
No. I thought it was okay because this was argument, and there has been lots of discussion about the distance. The other, of course, important issue for the court is the standard of review, and we certainly recognize that you have to give great weight deference to Lurk's determination, but the court can and should reverse Lurk when it's applied a statute contrary to the legislative intent or otherwise without rational basis. And I'd like to note that the court has reversed Lurk's application of the traveling employee statute on at least two other occasions that I could find. One is the Brogner case from, I think it's 1968, and the Hansen case from 1951. Now, in those cases, perhaps ironically from my point of view, the court overturned Lurk, finding that Lurk's application was too restrictive. One case involved, Lurk said you have to take the most direct route, and the court said no, as long as it's a reasonable alternative route. And in the Hansen case...
What if he had stayed in Dallas and that evening was hit crossing the street?
In my opinion, if once he made the decision to stay, to voluntarily stay beyond what was necessary for the business purpose of the trip, then, and he was doing something on his own for his personal reason, then yes, it would be a personal deviation. So, you know, you do have to look at, you know, his seminar ended at noon, he could have come back at 4, but he didn't. So, yeah, there is some time in there that you have to look at.
Doesn't that really conflict, counsel, with your company policy? That is, the conflict, is, as I see here, is that there was an incentive to... let's say, entice employees to hold over. And the reason for that is that the saving of $672 was one that would go to your company, WEPCO, and that was the difference in the airline fare. Isn't that a distinguishing difference here than just someone that would be holding over other than that? There isn't any evidence that he would or would have not held over. I don't know, and I guess I won't deal with that. But here, it seems to me to fly in the face of reasonableness if a person would stay over and do incidental things to save on his airfare.
Well, and that's what Lurk said. Yeah. That's what Lurk really points out on. I think that issue is irrelevant to the issue of whether somebody's engaged in a personal deviation. I think the fact that a company, and many companies I'm sure have the same policy, it's a win-win situation. If the employee chooses to stay over and the company saves the airfare costs, that's great. If they don't, it's up to them. The fact that we have that policy, I think is really irrelevant. I think it's kind of a red herring. In the Armstrong case, which I do cite extensively in my brief, the facts in that case make clear that the employer was paying for a rented apartment that Mr. Armstrong had in Detroit on a continuous basis. But that didn't prohibit him from embarking on a personal deviation.
But here the employer was also paying for the rental car. WEPCO was paying for the car that was taking them from point A to point B.
Yes, we do have a rather liberal policy, and I think we do allow employees to rent cars when they go to cities for business trips. And he did use it for going to dinner during the week.
Sure.
And I think the testimony at the hearing made clear, though, that, and once again, we probably would have reimbursed him, you know, up through Friday night, but once he started using that, you know, beyond Friday night, I think that that was on his own and his total personal use. But you're right, it's part of the expenses that the company would routinely pick up. But I don't think that's really relevant or determinative of whether an employee has engaged on a personal deviation, just because the employer is picking up expenses.
Well, counsel, what could the employee do until the employee left on Saturday, assuming the employee was going to leave immediately after the stayover? So 6 o'clock in the morning on Saturday, the employee is going to leave to go home. Okay?
Okay.
And you want him to stay through Friday night because you want to save the $600. That's what you've told the employee.
Okay, assuming, if there's an assumption there that the employer said, we want you to stay.
Okay, let's say the employer says, it's to our interest to save $600. We will pay you overnight if you stay so that we will save $600 less the hotel expense. We'll pay you dinner, right? Isn't that what you say to them?
Well, I think there is a difference whether the employer offers it to them as a voluntary choice or directs them to do it.
Okay, it's a voluntary choice. That's what you do, okay. Right? Okay. Now, the meeting ended what time?
In the Overby case? At noon.
So the meeting ended here at noon. What could the employee do that would retain coverage under workers' comp? Now, it can go to lunch, right, in the hotel.
Sure.
Go to lunch 2 blocks away from the hotel.
Sure.
20 miles away from the hotel.
Probably not.
10.
Possibly.
5.
Sure.
Okay. So it's between 5 and 10.
Or room service.
Definitely.
That's in the hotel. I'm not going to decide whether it's a second floor restaurant, and I assume you cover everything, right? Third floor?
Sure.
Penthouse. Okay. Now, we've eaten lunch within 2 blocks, so we're still covered. We walk back. Now, what can the employee do when lunch is over at 2, okay? No drinking, no women, okay?
All right.
What can the employee do? Do that stays covered. Goes back to the hotel room. All right, can take a shower, right? Watch TV.
Sure.
All right. Anything outside the hotel room that the employee can do that, in your opinion, will remain covered?
I think that once the employee voluntarily made the choice to stay over beyond what was necessary for the business purpose, to the extent they engage in anything other than what we would say was sort of restrictive eating, bathing, sleeping, you know, if they go on an entertainment basis, going to a show or a movie or something, I think that at that point that is a personal deviation. Not so much because the activity is unreasonable, but because they concluded the business part of the trip and said, hey, I'm going to stay over for my personal reasons.
You've got a bright line rule.
I would like to see one, yes. Yes, I think that is the difference between this case and the CBS case. You don't have to get into the minutiae of what is reasonable. I'm going to New York on a business trip, and if I stay over an extra night and go to a show, not going to a show in New York is not unreasonable, but the fact that I'm doing it because I voluntarily took the opportunity to stay over, that, I think, is what is determinative.
And
because at that point, it becomes personal.
It seems to me that you're asking for a very bright line. Just eating, sleeping, staying in the hotel room. If you deviate and you go out for 2 blocks to the nearest museum, that's out because it's personal.
Because then I'm doing it for my personal recreation.
And if ordinarily the employee jogs or runs or even walks, that would be out.
I honestly think that's a closer case because I think exercise is something that is one of those more like the incidents of daily living that we would do here. You know, if you stayed home, you might exercise every other day or whatever. So if you're on the road and you do it and you incorporate it, I think that's a closer case.
Well, you would say that's a necessity of life. I take it your bright line says necessities of life are covered, and maybe Chief's exercise example is a necessity of life.
I think so.
But you wouldn't go beyond necessities of life.
Not in the situation where you've described, the hypothetical we've set up, where the employee voluntarily stayed beyond what was necessary for the purpose of the business.
Necessity in my life is not exercise. Should be, but it's not. The necessity of my life would be I'd walk over, because it's too close to drive, to the Historical Society Museum if I were coming into Madison.
And no one...
I'd walk over to the Monona Terrace to see Frank Lloyd Wright architecture. But you wouldn't let me do that. But the walk might be covered if I say I was exercising. But going into the museum or into the building would not be.
Yes, I think so.
That's what your position would be. Okay.
I think so. Of course, now, and of course, in this case, we have several additional factors, which was why I think we can get to the point to say Lurk was, its decision was without rational basis. As somebody pointed out, Lurk essentially said that the only way you can engage in a personal deviation is to drink too much alcohol or go too far away, and I just don't think that's the limit that the legislature intended. Lurk also, what they did here is once they have adopted the premise that all innocent, reasonable recreational activities are covered, you know, they're not personal deviations, then to take that premise and just apply it to the facts in this case, that's also an unreasonable leap because, once again, of the difference. You know, sightseeing in and of itself probably isn't unreasonable, and if Mr. Overby had been sightseeing on Tuesday night, you know, in between seminar meetings, well, certainly after the CBS case, I don't think we would be here. We might have been here before then, but not after
that. You just said the magic words for me because I've been waiting to get a question about CBS, both you and Mr. Sobota. Do you think CBS was incorrectly or correctly decided?
Well, my personal opinion is that it was extremely significant for worker comp practitioners because it was the first time that a purely recreational activity had been determined to be an act reasonably necessary for a living or incidental thereto. And I honestly think there was a question in my mind before that about whether that is what was intended. And I have some doubts about
it. Okay. You probably like CBS overruled, but you could live with it if we didn't. But as I see it, the only principal distinction between CBS and your bright rule, the way we would distinguish CBS, would be that the business trip was not done, it was an interruption of a business trip in CBS. So we allowed them to go skiing on the slopes of Norway and still be covered. Are there any other distinctions?
I think that is the key distinction, that the employee was having to be there and basically was occupying his time or biding his time between business appointments. And that's where you get into, okay, well, how far can you go? And can you go across the street to the museum? Or, you know, it's about those. You really get into those questions and you really get into the reasonableness questions. But that is the key difference.
Well, the question is it a difference? The question is really, is there a difference when the employer offers for its purposes an opportunity to stay over?
I think there is a difference, yes.
Well, the business may be done, but the business of the employer to save money is not done. That is, the business meeting ended at noon, but the business purpose of the employer to save its funds continued on through Saturday morning at the first flight. So the question then is that really a difference?
I think it is.
Yeah, I would gather that, but
yes.
You could then say, but others might say it's not, because the employer still had a business purpose in offering this opportunity.
Yeah.
And it was an infringement on the employee's leisure time here of Saturday. I assume this employee did not work on Saturday.
True.
So therefore, the employer was asking this employee to travel for the purpose of the employer on a Saturday, giving up the employee's leisure time.
Well, we didn't ask him.
We offered.
Gave him.
Do you pay him extra for the Saturday work, that is, of traveling on Saturday?
No.
You don't.
Are they encouraged in any way? Excuse me.
I don't think so. I reread the hearing transcript right this morning, and just to confirm that, and the travel agent and Mr. Kerber were very clear in their testimony. For example, it's totally up to the employee which airline to fly to.
Sure.
The travel agent says, you know, here's the Midwest Express flight, but you can take American if you stop in Chicago and save $50. And the employee very wisely says, I'll take the Midwest Express. The travel agent says, fine. And once it's very similar, the travel agent says, now if you stay over Saturday, it's 161 versus 800, what do you want to do? And explains the policy that if you stay over, the company will reimburse you for the additional nights, lodging, and food to the extent it doesn't exceed the airfare savings. What do you want to do? If the employee says no, they say fine. And the travel agent testified, in fact, that most Wisconsin Electric employees don't stay over the extra night. Most of them return on the day that their business trip is concluded.
But it would seem to me that just with those facts, that would be the encouragement of this urge, this employee, to do something other than sit in his or her hotel room and wait until that first plane coming out on Saturday morning. I think that, you know, in CBS, there was a CBS van that was provided to go to the ski hill. I think there are a lot of similarities. What you're saying, the distinguishing factor is that CBS, that was during the assignment, and this was at the end.
Right. And I guess there's a One of the reasons I think the court should, you know, affirm the Court of Appeals and reverse Lurk is that were you to affirm Lurk's decision, I think, you know, I think it would work to the detriment of Wisconsin workers. I think employers really would seriously start to rethink their travel policies and put restrictions on where employees can go and what they can do. You know, well, personally, we've been considering it, but I've told them to hold off until we conclude the case, and I'm sure other employers are...
It would seem to me that what the employer would do would say, come home. If you want to stay afternoon, you're on your own time. Whether the employer restricts the activities goes, of course, to other statutory and maybe constitutional issues that Mr. Sobota referred to, but that's for another case. But clearly the most simple solution is the employer doesn't say anything. It says, look, you're done at noon. From our perspective, you take the first flight home. If you want to stay, you're on your own time.
And, you know, as I was preparing for this case and thinking of hypotheticals, I couldn't help but wonder after the CVS case, you know, I know I get those flyers for those CLE conferences in Vail, where you have the seminars in the morning and you ski in the afternoon, and I'm wondering if any law firms in Wisconsin have actually said, you know, maybe we should reconsider whether or not we allow the attorneys to go to those Vail seminars. I mean, that's the type of thing that employers would seriously look at.
Well, a justice of a Supreme Court, not this one, did on a trip... broke his or her leg and could not return timely for a business, much to that person's embarrassment. But that's another kind of issue. But I think there is an implied pressure that you should try and save the people's money. I have traveled a number of times for nonprofits and they always make the same offer. And sometimes the difference in airfares is horrendous, $1,000 or more. And there certainly is by the offer, a statement saying, we sure would like you to save the money. And I feel that pressure. So I can't believe that at least some of your employees don't feel that kind of pressure.
I'm a traveling employee for Wisconsin Electric a lot, and sometimes I do, but I make my decision based on what I do. My business isn't ending till 5 or 6 and the flight is at, 6 or 6:30, I have to say, well, no, I'm not going to leave early to catch it. I'll stay the next night. I think most people make their decisions based on their personal circumstances. I think, you know, maybe you're very fiscally responsible, but a lot of people who work for a big company maybe aren't quite as cognizant of a few hundred dollars to a very large company. I'm sorry.
Too bad.
Maybe they should be.
Our rates.
I thought I understood you to say that most company employees do not take advantage of this option?
That's correct. That's what the travel agent testified to at the hearing.
Is there anything in the record about whether this is a popular option among the employees?
The fact is, and this was the travel agent who, you know, did, it was an in-house person, it was a mega travel, but they had an office right in Wisconsin Electric, so she handled 20 or 50 arrangements per day for several years. And her testimony, and it was undisputed, was that most of the employees do not stay the extra night and get the reduced airfare. We didn't really put a number on it, it was just that most do not.
I bet it depends on where the meeting is being held.
It could depend on a lot of personal factors. If you travel a lot, travel maybe isn't as exciting to you anymore. And if you have small children, you want to get home to a lot of personal factors could affect
consumption. This is a subsection of 102.03. We're dealing with 102.03 sub F as I read it. And in other areas of 102.03, my recollection is under sub 1C, where we talk about rising out of services growing out of an incidental to an employment, or subsection 2, going to and from. I think we have cases that address the issue of benefit to the employer and that stand for the proposition that even though this may not normally be arising out of employment, that you assess the benefit to the employer, or in the going to and coming from cases, although it might be dealing with the direct route. You can, if you are making a deviation that benefits the employer, you know, going to and coming from work is a good example, and you stop at the Kinko's in order to pick up some stuff for your employer, but that can be covered. Why not apply the same benefit to the employer in this fact situation and say it benefits the employer to have the employee stay over, and therefore it's covered?
I think the difference is that the traveling employee is treated differently than the non-traveling employee, and I think the cases you're alluding to are, in the general rule, for example, coming and going from work is not a covered activity.
Unless you do something for the benefit of the employer.
That's where they get into those discussions. If, in fact, the employee is doing something on that route and it's benefiting the employer, that's where you get into that analysis, and then that may be enough for LURC and the courts to draw out within, okay, it's not just coming and going, it's really doing something within the course of the employment. Now, the traveling employee already does get broader protection than the non-traveling employee.
Yeah, but in this fact situation, what you have is the peculiar fact that they're saving the employer money. You may not have that in other fact situations, but in your fact situation, you're having the saving of money by staying over, which benefits the employer.
Well, that's true. I mean, that is a fact. A company saves several hundred dollars on the airfare, and I can't escape that. But as I've said, I just don't think that's determinative when you're analyzing a traveling employee case. It didn't stop the Armstrong court from finding a deviation. It didn't stop the Goranson case, the one with the truck driver and the bus driver in Green Bay. I'm sure the...
What's the name of that case?
Goranson. I'm sure the company was paying for the motel room that he jumped out of or was pushed out of or whatever. And in the Nice case, the traveling salesman, I'm sure the company here pays mileage and food and lodging. Companies always pay travel expenses for traveling employees. And I think it would be a shame to focus on that, you know, beneficial, generous policy and use it kind of as a sword against the employer to say, therefore, what is clearly a personal trip by the employee is now covered under worker comp because you were generous enough to do that. Well, maybe you're saving some money too, but it's a make sense policy, and I think it would be a shame to use that to find a coverage in this case.
Well, I agree with that. So isn't this amorphous, not totally predictable test of reasonableness a good one?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, my question is, the company does pay. The company does get a benefit. So, and we have a hard time distinguishing between what's necessary and what's not. And we agree, I think, that saying that the employee has to stick to the hotel room Friday afternoon is not quite what's going to happen. And it's not what we want necessarily, or what, more importantly, the legislature intended in F. So what's the matter with the reasonable test? I know it doesn't tell the employee exactly what the employee can do. It doesn't tell your company what exactly they're going to be liable for. Certainty is not present when you have a reasonable test. But isn't that the best you can do? And especially when the statute says reasonably necessary.
I think you're never going to get away entirely from the reasonableness test. And certainly in the circumstances like the CBS case, when we're talking about mere assignment and you're looking at particular activities of an employee, I think you do have to look at reasonable, that you have to interpret the language. But I do think it's possible, and you should have some bright line about once the business is included and the employees voluntarily extended the stay for personal reasons.
I can't shake you from that.
No, because I honestly, that's what the legislature intended. And, you know, there were these other facts in our case that were so dispositive in terms of the traveling of the distance and the joining of the spouse and these other things, which make it just so compelling.
What about a weekend stayover when the business does not end on Friday but is going to commence again on Monday and the injury occurs on Saturday or Sunday? Are you going to apply CBS or are you going to apply your case, your test?
Perhaps it would depend on whether the employee was offered the option. If the company said, you know, you have to stay over until Monday, we would really, you know, we want you to stay there so you don't have to come back and fly back. But or if the company says, it's totally up to you. If you want to come home and go back on Monday, you know, and the employee says, well, no, I'll just stay here, and then, of course, is doing things during the weekend to entertain himself, I think that would not be covered. I think, once again, it's hinging on the meaningful manifestation of what the employee is doing. What's the employee's purpose?
Does this mean the employee has to take the first flight out of Dodge? business ends noon on Friday. First flight back to Wisconsin's at 6 p.m. Are they covered if they just go to a museum or, you know, go 30 miles away between noon and 6? Are they covered?
In that case, that I think that you are still within the realm of the sort of midweek assignment, if you will, because the first opportunity for them to leave had not really occurred yet.
Okay, what if they decide to go to a movie and there's a second flight that goes out at 11 p.m., just 5 hours later, they're going to get home, same day, you know, they're leaving. What about that? Between the accident occurs between the first time a flight can go out and the next flight. I guess what I'm pushing at, of course, is this such a bright line rule? Then I'm going to say, well, then they take an opportunity to get bumped so they can get a free ticket for the company. You know, where's your bright line in all of this?
I think it really is important in terms of, say, the seminar ends at 12, they have an opportunity to leave at 4, but they choose to leave at 7. The fact that they chose to leave at 7, they're going to be doing something more in the afternoon than they would have if the flight had left at 4. So, I mean, that really is an important fact. I think that really would make a difference.
So your rule is they have to take the first flight out, or how about first mode of transportation? What if the bus left at 3, but the airplane left at 6?
No, I certainly wouldn't go that far. And, you know, one of the things that Lurk points to is obviously the fact that this accident happened on Friday afternoon. But, you know, I mean, that kind of leads into that point that if the overviews had not been scheduled to fly out later in the weekend, they wouldn't have been traveling to Fort Worth. So it's hard to say you've got to take their very next flight, but I think you can look at it and say, gee, are they staying over and are they doing stuff they wouldn't have done if they weren't staying over? You know, that's really what you're looking at. I guess I would also note, I actually have time left, that in some of the out-of-state cases that Mr. Savoy cited, most of them, as a matter of fact, I think all three of them that were cited in the brief did have the employee in that more mid-assignment situation. Now, the Lower New York case where they went on the boat trip, I reread that again, and it does talk about how, in that case, the employee was traveling with the manager.